Hi, my name's Jim Bakiai. I am the author of two books. One's called How to Hire the Perfect Employer, and the second book is called True Fit, How to Find the Right Job by Being You. So oftentimes when I'm interviewing people, I say, so tell me about yourself. And it's remarkable how everybody has a different way about telling you. Most people think that what they should tell you about is the trip itinerary of their life, of where they've worked, which job, what title, how much they made, and everything else. But when I say to people, tell me about yourself, I want to know about them. And so probably the best way to begin this broadcast is, let me tell you about myself. So I grew up in an immigrant family in Ottawa. Father passed away when I was 10 years old. Like all good immigrant families, we ran restaurants. My family thought it was great that they took me off the street. I was working in the family restaurant from the age of 10 till I left high school to go to university, where I attended Queen's University, kind of an uneventful academic career, never really got engaged in the aspect of learning. Enjoyed my time there, but never really figured out what I was doing there, what I was supposed to be doing there. And of course, you know, my parents were of no help. My mother was of no help, and anybody else in my family, because none of them ever gone to university, let alone high school. But I kind of figured it out. I worked while I was at university. I enjoyed working. It was something that I found came naturally to me. I worked in a bar. I worked as part of the concert group, so I got to meet all the bands. I worked as a marker of tests and things like that. And so working came naturally to me. Being an entrepreneur came naturally to me. And so I thought, well, what am I going to do? All of my friends were studying to be chartered accountants. So I thought, that seems to be okay, so why don't I do that as well? Not having realized the last thing in the world I should ever be doing is chartered accounting, or accounting in any capacity. And I was saved in my fourth year when I interviewed with every accounting firm in the country, and every single one of them turned me down. And a gentleman by the name of Patrick O'Neill from Price Waterhouse called me and said, you know, would you be available for a beer after work, after school? And I said, sure, absolutely, not a problem. And he said, listen, I'm going to do you a favor and the entire accounting industry a favor and tell you not to be an accountant. So you can imagine I was a bit deflated, because here I'd done all this accounting work, hated accounting. None of it suited me. None of it suited my brain. None of it suited any aspect of my life, but for some reason, I was just blindly going along, one foot after another, following the crowd. So in fourth year, I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do, and someone says, hey, Wood Gundy is looking for people. And I'm like, Wood Gundy? What is Wood Gundy? And little did I know, because we didn't have any stocks, we didn't have any bonds in our family, it was probably the premier investment dealer in Canada and one of the oldest investment dealers. You couldn't get more sort of WASP, right, you know, old school than Wood Gundy. And so I went for my interviews, seemed to go well, ended up starting out there, found I kind of had a knack with clients, kind of had a knack on a whole bunch of things, and ended up rising through the ranks. Company went broke at one point, bought by CIBC. It was a great opportunity for me, because a lot of my ideas were being rejected. And I didn't quite understand, because I thought the whole idea was to make the place better and figure out how to make more money. But my first lesson was, it's only better if it's better for the people in charge. It's not necessarily better for everybody. And so CIBC came. It was a new break for me. I grew up on the capital market side of the business. The business grew. I took over nationally. I took over international. And at the age of 37 years old, just a young pup, I found myself being handed the president and chief operating title, which I'd never expected, to tell you the truth. I know most people that go to Harvard and MBA school all come out with dreams of being the CEO one day, but I didn't have those dreams and I didn't have those aspirations or expectations. My only goals were to do a better job, make more money, and sort of continue to live a better life. And along the way, challenge the status quo, which I loved doing. Lo and behold, things take off, doing very well, and I convinced the bank to integrate their corporate investment bank, to build derivatives, to build high yield. I go to New York, move there for 4 years, come back, and I want to continue growing. And everybody says, well, why don't we just take a pause here for a second? I said, what, pause what? Like, I mean, we're on a roll here, and tried to buy Lehman Brothers and wanted to buy some banks and made a presentation to the board. And it was actually quite funny because I was talking about, you know, what I wanted the bank to do. And one of the board members said to me, you know, if we do what you say we should do, we won't look like any of the other Canadian banks. And I sort of tapped my nose as you would do, bing, 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 bing. And I said, exactly. And this old sort of board member turned to the board member beside him and said, I don't think he quite understood what I was saying. And he said to me, he said, no, I think he understood. I don't think you understood what he was saying. 48 hours later, I got fired. And after 19 years of being in the organization, and I was told that they couldn't live up to my expectations or aspirations, even though I said, what are those? They couldn't answer it. And when you get fired in the securities industry, you're out. 5 minutes after they say we no longer need you. And it took me a while to figure out that what they're really saying is, you don't fit here anymore. Not you've done a terrible job. There's being fired for doing a terrible job, but you don't fit here anymore. And it was an important lesson that I wasn't quite aware of at the time. So I take the summer off. I'm remarried. I have a new child on top of the three that I have. And I get a job offer from the Bank of Montreal. Looks like a great offer, great opportunity. But what I didn't realize was, you know, they had a bigger appetite than they had a budget. And they didn't really understand what they were getting with me. And notwithstanding, they said, you know, all that stuff you did over there at CIBC, we want to do that here too. They didn't really want to do it. And I think that's another lesson that sort of came out is what people say and what people do aren't necessarily one and the same. People have goals and aspirations and desires and stuff like that, but never actually take the time to stop and say, okay, what does that actually mean? What do we actually have to do about that? How much money do we have to spend? So anyways, I was there, loved the people. Some of my best friends are still there, and one of my key clients is still there. But 2 years later, lo and behold, I get fired again. And as if fate is a funny thing, they tell me again, we can't live up to your expectations and aspirations. So now I'm like, really, like, man, are my expectations and aspirations that much bigger than anybody else's? And the answer was, yes, they are. My dreams for the organization, my view of how great they could be, were substantially greater than everybody else's. Everybody else was satisfied with what they had. And I just never got that gene. I don't know whether it's being an immigrant family, I don't know what it is, but I never got that gene. I was always, how do we make it better? How do we do it differently? How can we improve? So I'm on the beach. You can imagine getting fired by two Canadian banks. It's not a long list of people that you can find out there that would actually have that moniker behind their name. You know, it's not ESQ. It's fired by two Canadian banks. So I've had our second child, my fifth, and while we're expecting our sixth child, one of my children became very ill and required to have brain surgery. And I was kind of on a slippery slope because I'm watching all these people make money and organizations grow, and I can't get a job. And if you want a sobering impact, you know, have one of your children get really sick and you realize all the rest of the stuff doesn't matter. And I figured out, I got to figure out how to make a living. I got to figure out what people should pay me for. And it was an important moment for me because I had to actually ask myself, what should someone pay me for? And I realized that that is a $64,000 question of life. What's in it for them to hire me? What is it that I can do for them that makes them money or saves them time? I couldn't answer that question. And so I sat up at the cottage. I was on the dock one day and I said, what were those days where I would come home from work and just say to myself, God, this is such a great day. If I could do this every single day, I would be so happy. And then the second thing was, God, if I ever have to do the things I did today, I think I could shoot myself. And so it helped me down this journey of sort of understanding. And for me, those days of just utter joy of what I did, wasn't when I got a big bonus. It wasn't when I got a big promotion. They were centered around three things. The first being hiring people. I loved hiring people, whether we would hire waitresses at the restaurant, in my summer jobs, or in all my years at Wood Gundy, I'd hired, in CIBC, I'd hired over 400 people. I'd never used a recruiter because I was looking for the essence of finding that person that just fits seamlessly. It's like adding a member to your family. You know, when your daughter, your son is getting married, you ask yourself the question, who are they dating? Is it accretive to your family, right? Do they bring something to the party? And I was really good at it. And I had lots of experience at it. And I had a good nose for it. The second thing I realized is I was really good at looking at businesses and figuring out why they didn't work. The number one reason businesses don't work is you have the wrong people in it. There are no bad businesses. There are only the wrong people in the business. There's occasionally some bad people, but by and large, let's just say it's the wrong people in the wrong job. And the third thing I was really good at, and this sort of was throughout my life, even as a kid working in the restaurant, listening to waitresses about how to improve and stuff like that, I was really good at listening to people and understanding the blockages that they had to improving themselves. And it usually manifested around a fear or an insecurity of actually saying what they wanted to say. And so they went about sort of being in denial. So that's what people should pay me for, I figured. These three things: hiring people, fixing businesses, looking at businesses, and coaching people. And then I said, you know, in my career, I've had a great opportunity to work with a lot of people. Some of the people have been seamless, just seamless. And other people have just been a complete effort. So there must be something about those people that has been seamless that has made it effortless for me to work with them. So I better figure out what that is. And so I went about making a list of all the people that I'd ever worked with, teachers, part-time jobs, just in general. And for all of you out there, you know it, right? You know that some people you meet and it's effortless and you feel like you've known them forever. And other people you've known forever, you feel like you hardly know them. And so there must be something, chemistry in the air or something that makes it. You have a cadre of close friends that it's effortless with. It doesn't mean that they're all friends with each other, but there's something. So I sort of worked my way and I realized I hate micromanagers. I can't work with people that micromanage me. I also can't work with people that just want me to blindly go and do their bidding without the ability to discuss it or anything else. And lastly, probably the most important thing I realized is I can't work with people that don't fundamentally trust. It's okay with me if they don't trust, but I can't work with people that don't trust because people that don't trust question everything that you do. And my view is if you're always questioning someone's motives, then you'll never be comfortable enough to trust and delegate. So as I'm going through this journey of self-discovery, I'm realizing that I'm actually rediscovering myself. I'm actually saying it's okay to be me because I'm finding the core essence of who I am. So, why am I doing this podcast? I'm on a mission, and I've seen the body of work that I have in my coaching. I've seen the work that I've done in my recruiting. I've seen the success of people acknowledging who they are and not being afraid to stand up for themselves. Far too many people are easily bowled over, and the ones that aren't are selfish, and they get everything. And I'm tired of them winning. I actually want to help the people that do care about a company, that do care about people. And the reason people don't have it to stand up for themselves is because they're afraid that they're not going to get the answer they want. And my view on that is, if you're not afraid of the answer being no, then you hold all the power. And so when I started my recruiting practice and I started my coaching practice, I come across people and I quickly realized that 9/10 of the people are afraid to be themselves. They're afraid to not get that deal. They're afraid to not get that job. They don't actually realize that no is a good thing for not getting that job. That if they actually stood back and upon reflection, They don't even want that job, right? I remember some time ago, somebody said to me early on in my coaching, they said, well, you know, I like to interview a little differently. You know, if I'm interviewing for the Royal Bank, I show them this person. If I'm interviewing for the Bank of Montreal, I show them that person. And I said, well, that's all well and good, but what happens if the Royal Bank's looking for the BMO person and the BMO's looking for the Royal Bank person? I said, then neither of those will work for you. I said, why don't we try to get one constant, and that one constant being yourself? So I set about, wrote my first book, How to Hire the Perfect Employer. I wrote the second book. It has been a complete amazement to me how strong it has made individuals. And I actually hadn't anticipated that. It helped me greatly in my personal life and relationships. And when I talk about this stuff about standing up for yourself, I don't mean in a disrespectful way or in a rude fashion, but it's okay to stand up for yourself. It's okay to say that doesn't work for me, right? We are raised all of our lives to sort of like, what do you want to do tonight? I don't know, what do you want to do tonight? As opposed to saying, well, this is what I'd like to do, because you're fearful that, well, maybe they don't want to do that. Well, okay, if they don't want to do that, they should say something. And so it's building this confidence in people that it's okay to be them. And oftentimes, you know, I put my hand on their arm and I say, it's okay to be you. And they go, yeah, no, I know. And I said, no, it's okay to be you. Okay, so it gives you an idea of who I am, what I'm doing, and why I'm doing it. What you should look forward to hearing about is to reorient your thinking around how do I improve in every aspect of my life. We've all been raised to think of ourselves, whether our parents or our teachers, to work on the things that you're weak at. Get better at the things that you're not very good at. Don't worry about the things you're good at. You're really good at those. You don't need to spend any time. But it's come to me later in life that that's a really inefficient way of maximizing your skill set. And the recognition of what I am good at and what I'm not good at, and more importantly, things I'll never be good at, is a waste of my time. But unfortunately, all of our upbringing, all of our education, everything else. By the way, I have a newfound appreciation for the Montessorial system. Because in that system, as you may or may not know, it encourages children to follow their natural path of strengths. And like everyone else in the world, I grew up immigrant family, like work hard, work on the things you're weak at. But the reality is, if you're honest with yourself, you'll realize I suck at this stuff and I've always sucked at it. And you know, it's interesting because then it sort of starts to manifest itself in that, God, you can't feel good about yourself if you're a failure at all the things that you're not good at, but you should say to yourself, it doesn't matter. I'm not good at them. I'll never be good at them. And I'm not talking about the things at the margin. I'm talking about the ends. All my life, school teachers, parents, job performance reviews, everybody said to me, always, you're not very detail-oriented. You're not very detail-oriented. In actual fact, what I've come to realize later in life, I'm extremely detail-oriented, but I'm binary in my detail orientation. If I'm interested in it, I go very deep. If I'm not, I won't even look at it. Yet there are people out there that are detail-oriented about being detail-oriented. Every aspect of their life is detail-oriented. Their clothes are in order. Their socks are in order. They're not scrambling to find things, losing stuff and stuff like that. And if you don't understand that subtle difference between two people, you could mistakenly ask me to do something that will turn out to be a disaster. And what's wrong with saying to people, you shouldn't really have me do that, because there has to be someone that could do that better than me. The other thing we'll spend a fair bit of time talking about is one of the key questions I always say to people is, what's the best and the worst thing anybody's ever said about you professionally? And the reason that I ask that question is because I found that question really strikes at the heart of the things that make you feel best and the things that make you feel worst, what people say about you. And if you don't understand those bookends of how people view you, then it's really hard to progress to understand why people see you that way. And so in my life, the best thing anybody has ever said for me is, you're the best person I've ever worked for because you've taken a huge interest in my development and my career and everything else. The worst thing anybody's ever said about me is I am the most selfish prick they've ever met in my life. And I realize why people feel that way. And it took me a long time to understand it, because for a long time I go, no, you misunderstand me. I'm not really like that. I'm this person over here. But I realized when I actually sat down and thought about the two groups, I realized that the people that felt the positive way about me were people that had worked with me closely. The people that had seen me as the other person had only an external perspective on me, and they didn't really know me. So one of the podcasts will be dedicated to sort of how people see you and why they see you that way. Another future podcast will be talking about really understanding people. And, you know, oftentimes people say to me, why don't they get it, right? Why don't they get it, right? I can't understand why they don't get it. And I always say they can't get it. And because if they could get it, they would get it. So you have one of two alternatives. You can keep pushing on that same string, or you can figure like a Rubik's Cube, I got to solve this thing a little differently, right? And it's an interesting process, because one of the key components of the process is getting people to first and foremost understand it is the responsibility of the person speaking to ensure the other person gets the message. Used to drive me crazy when people would say to me, do you get it? Do you understand what I was just talking about? And I go, no. They go, what do you mean you didn't get it? I explained it perfectly clearly. And I always say, well, if you explained it perfectly clearly, then I would get it. But it's not perfectly clearly to me. And so why does that happen? You know, I'm sure this resonates with people. They've been in that conversation. And so helping people understand. And then one of the podcasts I'd like to dedicate some time to is the circle of knowledge. There are three pieces to the circle of knowledge. You know what you know what you don't know, and you don't know what you don't know. And it is impossible to get out of I don't know what I don't know by yourself. My mother used to say the children are born naked mentally and physically. And the only way you can get from I don't know what I don't know to I know what I don't know is to trust people. Kate, trust me, don't touch that burner because it's hot. Okay, Dad, I won't touch that burner. Or, Kate, don't touch that burner because it's hot. Trial and error. So if we're helping people get out of that, how do we do that? So I do that by telling stories, by educating people. I don't believe in selling people. And what I want to do in the podcast is educate people. I'm not here to give you a prescription how to live your life, or to tell you to do this, and if you did this and you did this. I want to use my voice, my experiences, and my examples of a life that educates other people, and through their own eyes, through that education, they can see it. Because the fact of the matter is, nobody wants to be told. That's the one thing I've learned. Nobody wants to say, you know, if you just did this, you'd be okay, right? If you just did, follow this, just do what I tell you. Do what I tell you. But if I said, you know, here's some examples of some situations that are similar, maybe not identical, but you might be able to learn from, right? I find people's physical demeanor changes when you tell a story, and I'm a storyteller. I love to tell stories. I love to tell jokes. I may throw in a few of my jokes along the way in the podcast. So these are some of the things that I hope you will look forward to hearing from me about. The one thing I'll tell you is you'll get the unvarnished version of how I feel about things. You'll get things that I've tried and are tried and true that I've worked with many, many people on. And I'm here to help you get a better job, have a happier environment, and just enjoy life a heck of a lot more than probably have in the past. And maybe you've had a great life. I'm hoping going to help you make it even greater. So look forward to connecting with everybody. And until the next time, this is Jim Bakiai saying goodbye.